This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Thanks very much for tuning in. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about Afghanistan. Hundreds of people have been killed in Afghanistan since the beginning of the year, making this the most violent period since the fall of the Taliban back in 2001. It was in that year, at the end of 2001, that Hamid Karzai was chosen to lead an interim government. The next year, he became president. He was re-elected to a five-year term in 2004, and a new parliament was inaugurated just last year. This government has faced and continues to face very serious problems. Attacks by the Taliban continue. There are parts of the country that are controlled by warlords and their militias. It also seems that a growing number of people in Afghanistan are feeling very frustrated with the lack of progress in rebuilding that country after many, many years of war, and also with the problem of corruption in government. In this hour of the program, we'll talk a little bit about Afghanistan, what's going on now, and about prospects for the future with someone who has been following politics in Afghanistan for a long time, 30 years at least, more probably. His name is Thomas Gutierrez. He serves as the Dean of International Studies and Programs at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. He is also director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies there and has been for more than 30 years. Before he took up his job back in the mid-70s, he lived and worked for nearly 10 years in Afghanistan. He was in the Peace Corps there. He was also a Fulbright Fellow and Executive Director of the Fulbright Foundation. He has served as the Senior Political Affairs Officer on the UN peacekeeping mission to Afghanistan in 1996 and 1997. He also served as a member of the International Rescue Committee's Citizens Commission on Afghanistan Refugees from 1988 until 1993. He has testified on various topics related to Afghanistan, on U.S.-Pakistani relations, international terrorism and human rights, before hearings of the Senate, the Foreign Relations Committee, also the House Committee on International Relations. She has also testified on Afghanistan and human rights issues in hearings before committees of other legislatures, including the British Parliament, the French National Assembly, and the UN Select Committee on Human Rights. He's joining us this morning by telephone as we talk. Questions are certainly welcome. Questions, comments are welcome. The only thing that we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving along and get in as many different people as possible. So anyone's welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers to call. Professor Gutierrez, hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Well, thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Nice to be with you.
Certainly, in a lot of the recent reporting on Afghanistan that I have been reading, it seems that I see a lot of the same kinds of things, and also a lot of references to this growing frustration among Afghan people about the issue of corruption in government, about the lack of progress in rebuilding the country, seemingly some growing criticism or lack of confidence in the president, Mr. Karzai. Here's one example. For example, just yesterday, a rather lengthy story on this published in the New York Times, quoting, for example, this man Ahmad Fahim Hakim, who is deputy chair of the Afghan Independent Human Rights Commission, and here he is quoted as saying, "Nothing that he, that is Mr. Karzai, has promised has materialized." He goes on to say, beneath the surface, talking about the atmosphere, particularly in Kabul, he says, "Beneath the surface, it is boiling." Can you comment on that, and particularly on this feeling right now that people are unhappy because they feel that somehow this government and Mr. Karzai by this time should have been able to accomplish more?
Well, I'm recently returned from Afghanistan, and I can tell you that I found similar kinds of feelings amongst Afghans there, but people very, very concerned, and I think the term frustration is as good a descriptive term as any. And I think a lot of that's predicated on the fact that, first of all, Afghans had very, very high expectations following the defeat of the Taliban in 2001, and the swearing in of the first process involving Hamid Karzai, and then eventually the elections and constitution and elections and all that ensued thereafter. Those expectations were predicated on nearly 30 years of instability and violence and war and death and destruction in Afghanistan, and the hope that there was going to be a turnaround with the presence of the United States in Afghanistan once again. And I think some of those expectations were probably unrealistic, but understandable, given what the Afghans had undergone. And I think some of the frustrations are based upon the fact that a lot of the reconstruction and rebuilding processes have not progressed as they should have, and as I think even reasonable expectations might have hoped that they might, along which lines they might hope to proceed. And unfortunately, this is a part of a overall plan which is not very well conceived on behalf of the donors. And of course, all of this then reflects poorly on the activity of the Afghan government. And and while the Afghans themselves cannot be left unaccountable for any of this, at the same time, given the state in which Afghanistan was in the beginning of 2002, in which many people said, you know, it's going to take Afghanistan at least 10 years to get back to 1973, the fact is that the progress has been exceedingly slow. I think Afghans have thought initially there'd be more money coming into Afghanistan. They know that that money now has been diverted to Iraq for the war there, and so they're all aware of these things. The drug issues haven't been resolved, but I think at the heart today of a lot of this frustration is the deteriorating security situation with the very, very obvious presence of the neo-Taliban and their ability to strike terror and to intimidate, as well as to cause death.
Yeah. But let's come back to we'll come back to that in a moment. I'm interested in having you talk a little bit more specifically about give some kind of assessment of the performance of President Karzai. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, he just in 2004 he was reelected to a 5-year term, so he's only a couple of years into his into this term and will be there in office until 2009 or 2010. I'm not sure exactly how this runs, but also that I'm interested in that, for example, again, this piece, I don't want to say that this is the be-all or end-all, this piece in the New York Times, though, talked about the fact that perhaps even though now Mr. Karzai is only 2 years into a 5-year term, people are starting to talk about who was going to come next, as if to suggest that they're almost, well, I don't want to say that they're giving up on him, but they're saying they're already looking ahead to the possibility perhaps there could be somebody else, and then perhaps that person would do better. Admittedly, he came into a very difficult situation. You know, it would not have been easy for anyone. But having said that, how well do you think he has done?
Well, if you take a look at the aggregate of the time that he's been there, you're right. He was actually elected for the first time in a nationwide vote in 2004 to be president before he really was approved by the Loya Jirga process and before that even a international group in Bonn, Germany. So, but nonetheless, he's been the leader of the country since the very last days of 2001, and so people tend to see him as having been president, for a period now that is in its fifth year, and they again see that a lot has not happened, and I think there are frustrations. And in terms of, grading him one way or the other, you got to remember that almost every Afghan who is in his government, including himself, has not had the experience before of managing anything near the size of an enterprise or office that he or she now is managing in Afghanistan. So a lot of what any Afghan administrator, including President Karzai, is going to be doing is not only trying to advance various projects, programs, activities, political agendas, etc., but learning on the job, because they've never had that kind of experience before. Also, we've got to remember that Afghanistan, in many, many ways, remains, of course, a nation with tribal inclinations, tribal type of society. And in tribal societies, people seek consensus first as a political process. And when you seek consensus, oftentimes you are not, an individual is not decisive. And I think people feel that in the process of seeking consensus, Hamid Karzai hasn't been perhaps as decisive in certain types of decision taking that they were expecting from him. Now, again, we've got to understand another part of all this, and that is that in Afghanistan, politics are very, very active. And if you go to any country where there's a democratic process engaged, our own, of course, included, but many others, you find criticism coming from a variety of sources. And these are stimulated by facts or real situations, but they're also stimulated by political competition and political agendas. And that plays into this as well. I think there have been some major accomplishments. You go through a process where in a country where for 30 years there was a relatively stateless society, you introduce the process to bring about a constitution. There is a constitution that has been approved. There have been elections in Afghanistan for a president, and there have been subsequent parlamentary elections. Those are very, very important achievements. You find cabinet nominees being brought before parliament, approved, and also rejected. That's a part of the process, again, that is engaged and in proceeding. These things are happening. You have roads that have been rebuilt. You have schools that have been rebuilt. You have schools that have been reopened. There are more kids in school than at any time in Afghanistan. But I think what most people in Afghanistan are frustrated about is that their own individual lives, as they see it, have not been improved much since this whole process has started with Karzai and with the presence of foreign donors and foreign experts, that much of what they have witnessed as progress within their own lives, they brought about themselves. The fact that they're able to be in an environment where they're now again confident and have trust that they can invest their own money, that's important. But are very important things that aren't being delivered. There's water issues, energy issues, security issues. These are in the foremost, thoughts of the Afghan population. And in many ways, the standard of living for the Afghan, other than the fact that there is better security and some hope for the future and certainly more freedom than during the period under the Taliban or those years before that, still hasn't improved that much financially. And they blame Karzai, whether it's his fault specifically or whether indeed it has to do with the ineffectiveness of the donor countries and their organizations. They're kind of lumped together. And I think in many ways, the verdict is still out. There are things that are in progress, that are improving, but there are many things that really have not seen much progress at all. And that is, for example, establishing an alternative economy for those who are engaged in the illegal narcotics business, which is still the largest industry in the country. People are aware of that as a failure, too. So there are successes, there are failures, and I think in many ways Much of what people will be deciding will be based upon how effective will be the campaigns against the Taliban through the rest of this fighting year.
Let's go to that. Well, before I do that, maybe I ought to introduce again real quick our guest, Thomas Gutierrez. He's director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha and has been following politics in Afghanistan for a long time, going back to the 1970s.
Actually, 1960s. I started in Afghanistan in 1964, so I hate to have to admit that because it tends to date me all the more, but... But of course, I was just a 4-year-old kid, right? Not really.
Well, that was when you were in the Peace Corps.
Yeah, that's right. I was 24 when I went to Afghanistan in 64. And the one thing you didn't mention in your introduction that I always like to throw in there is that I coached the Afghan national basketball team for most of a 10-year period there, and I learned a lot about Afghanistan in that process, and it helped me very much to learn the language as well.
Yeah. Well, our guest here, Thomas Gutierrez, and if you have questions, people who are listening have questions, certainly, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. One of the things that you did mention a little bit earlier was the as a source of concern and unhappiness for people is the security situation, and one of the things we have to point to is the I'm not sure if resurgence is exactly the right kind of word, but there is continuing Taliban activity. Perhaps nothing like it once was, although the Taliban, they're not gone. They didn't go away. And recently, there was just, it was yesterday or the day before, there was a significant fight between NATO and Afghan troops and Taliban in the south of Afghanistan. In what way is this significant? What's it important to know about that?
Well, it is very significant, and it has not gone away. And the reason is, of course, is that while the coalition forces and their Afghan allies did drive the Taliban out of Afghanistan, they didn't, in a sense, truly defeat them because they were able to escape and they went into Pakistan. And over the last several years, the number of recruits to what I call the neo-Taliban movement, this is a different kind of thing now, which is a reconstituted aggregation of former Taliban partisans as well as Al-Qaeda partisans, and many new recruits from the madrasas in Pakistan, many Pakistanis, and many other foreigners from outside Afghanistan who've been stimulated to fight in Afghanistan as a way to express their dissatisfaction with Western policies in the Islamic world, and whether that be Iraq or the recent situation involving Israel and Lebanon and the Hezbollah, or American policies regarding Iran. But in any case, we've noted that there probably have been more terrorists, recruited in recent years than there were even in the years leading up to 9/11. And in fact, the real war on terrorism never was fully finished. There was no mission accomplished there, other than driving the Taliban, at least for the early period, out of Afghanistan. But they now are coming back with refurbished supplies and new tactics, and they're terrorist tactics. You said you don't know whether or not we can call this an insurgency, but in a sense it is, and it's an insurgency that's using terrorist tactics, but it's becoming more and more emboldened. They occupy governmental offices for a period of time until they're driven out. That's a very, very major achievement for an insurgency of any kind. And while I don't believe that the people of Afghanistan are in any way attracted to the philosophy of this neo-Taliban movement, they are intimidated by their successes and then, again, their frustration with the ineffectiveness of the Karzai government and its coalition allies to preclude this from happening. And we've got to recognize that most of the U.S. effort, of course, is in Iraq. And we never have had anywhere near the number of military personnel in Afghanistan that we have currently in Iraq. And we have a border that is the distance between Omaha and Boston, which is the Afghan-Pakistani border, over which people can move back and forth, and in which we have never had more than, you know, maybe 7,000-8,000 people. Well, you can't do much along that distance of about 1,500 miles to interdict the passage of these terrorists and the material they need to intimidate and to kill. And so they're being also funded in a kind of an alliance of strange bedfellows, the narcotics, illegal narcotics industry, and helps to channel monies into these organizations. And so they're again, in a sense, somewhat on the rise, and we have not ever established a deck of cards to get Osama bin Laden and Zawahiri and Gulbuddin Hikmetyar and others like them, and they're out there still waging this war of terrorism and in the battlefield of Afghanistan.
Well, given just one quick point here, and then I'm going to get some calls. Right? Given the everything that you said, particularly the difficulties of the terrain of fighting this kind of war, and of the complicity of people in Pakistan, they say they're with us, but obviously that it's the situation there is much more complex than that, and that I'm sure that the Taliban does indeed find some support, and they're able to operate on that side of the border and cross over the border and then go back. Given all of that, one wonders what it would take for a decisive military defeat of the Taliban. Theoretically, it should be possible, but in reality, would it take so much time and so much force that it would make it seemingly just impossible?
Well, and you hit upon the very, very important element relating to that, and that is the situation vis-a-vis the Pakistani government and the Pakistanis themselves. And in many ways, the government of Pakistan has a schizophrenic foreign policy regarding Afghanistan. There are many in the government who are, I think, firmly committed to the destruction of terrorism in their midst, as well as those terrorists that can go back and forth into Afghanistan. But I think there are many others who are not, who believe, because of their paranoia of India, that a stable nation-state on Pakistan's western border would be more likely to, as it has in the past, be friendly with India, and then that this is not in Pakistan's best interest. So you have many former members of the ISI, the Inter Services Intelligence Unit of the military, which is a kind of combination CIA and FBI in Pakistan, who continue to be very supportive of jihadi movements and jihadi elements that are within Pakistan and that are continuing to be trained there and educated in the very, very extreme fundamentalist madrasas that are in large number in Pakistan. Kids go there to these madrasas because the public school system in Pakistan is so poor. The madrasa schools are much better. The point you made towards the end of your question or your comment is very, very valid. You know, how long is it going to take before we can see an end to the this Taliban style of terrorism in Afghanistan? And until we really have the full cooperation of Pakistan, which I think we have in a divided fashion. People still go back and forth. You have to wonder where is Mullah Muhammad Omar and others who seemingly are unfindable in anywhere in that region, although we know they can't be too far away. Who knows? And one thing we've got to remember, that all along the Afghan border with Pakistan. In Pakistan itself are these tribal agencies, which are a part of the Northwest Frontier province of Pakistan, and to which the government writ and real control of Pakistan does not extend very deep. And so there's a lot of kind of stateless area there into which the neo-Taliban can move, retreat, train, build up, because there is no real governmental interdiction possible because of the fact that the Pakistanis really don't reach well into that area. Mm-hmm. Well, it's a serious situation, and it is in many ways the most serious challenge that faces Hamid Karzai and his government and the Afghans in general, whether it be another person who would be the leader, and of course the coalition forces that constitute Afghanistan's allies currently.
Let's talk with some folks here who are listening. We'll go to Champagne, line number two.
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, interestingly, I was reading the editorial page of the New York Times when your program came on, and one of the columns is caption or title, Losing Afghanistan. I want to read the last paragraph of it and get your response to it, if I may. It's very brief. Americans are coming to see the war in Iraq as something apart from the war against 9/11-style terrorism and a distraction from it. The war in Afghanistan has always been an essential part of that larger struggle. That makes it a war that America simply cannot afford to lose.
Well, I agree with that. That is the initial war, and I think this is still the same war on terrorism. And again, those people that attack the United States and that are actively engaged in terrorist attacks and plans around the world, like the recent airplane incidents in Great Britain, they remain from that unit. And I think you know, to combine the war in Iraq with the war on terrorism and not, you know, redouble our efforts in the latter, the war on terrorism, invites a chance that we may lose Afghanistan again, and at least in some way, or we're going to have to muddle through in a process of rebuilding a situation there because we haven't addressed it effectively early on. In last year, Hamid Karzai came, of all places, to Omaha, Nebraska, after he visited Washington, D.C. The first message he gave everywhere he spoke here was, don't forget Afghanistan. We know you are busy in Iraq, but remember, Afghanistan is your ally. We need to be engaged against the terrorists together, and he repeats that. And I'm really very, very apprehensive that we're going to lose the best opportunity we have in the Muslim world, where there is no ambiguity about whether or not the Afghans want us in their country, working with them on their reconstruction and the restoration of security and the restoration of their state. The thing they're most concerned about is that we might dump them again like we did in 1989 after the Soviets left Afghanistan. And what happened is what we know, is that into that vacuum came extremist Islamist forces and the Pakistani military with their own agendas. And Afghanistan was hijacked and became this, center for the training of terrorists. And then all of a sudden, after we went in after those terrorists, we wound up being even more engaged in Iraq without having really completed the job. So we faced the risk of losing this great opportunity that we have to do the job right in Afghanistan, where the people really do want us, because we have become distracted to such a great extent in this other war, and we got to remember that if we don't do it right in Afghanistan, we're going to have this whole thing come apart for us there as well.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. We're a little bit past our midpoint here, and I will get on to some other callers in just a moment. I do want to reintroduce our guest, if you might have just tuned in. We're talking with Thomas Gutierre. He's the Dean of International Studies and Programs at University of Nebraska at Omaha. He's also director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies there, and has been for more than 30 years. He's been involved in and following politics in Afghanistan going back to the mid-1960s, where he started out there in Afghanistan as a Peace Corps volunteer. He also was a Fulbright Fellow and executive director of the Fulbright Foundation. He's testified before the Congress, in the Senate, in the House, before the British Parliament, the French National Assembly, the UN Select Committee on Human Rights, has made many presentations on this subject, also things like global terrorism and U.S. foreign policy, has written many papers on this subject. He's joining us by telephone, and of course, questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we do have another caller here. We'll go to Champaign County next, line 3. Hello.
Hi. I think it's always important to remind ourselves that we worked with the ISI to make Afghanistan a center for training of people who were employing terrorist tactics against the Russians in 79, and it was kind of an instrumental sort of thing, and I guess you can say, well, maybe that was a good strategy, but walking away certainly wasn't. So, you know, that's the definition of blowback that the CIA uses, Chalmers Johnson has written about. But I heard Sarah Chase, who was formerly an NPI stringer, probably interviewed you at some point. She's now working in sort of micro economy projects, working like making soap and trying to get some kind of low-level development going on in Afghanistan and crop substitution, as it's called, to give people something to grow other than opium. But she said something, she didn't elaborate on it, but maybe you can. It's the motives of Pakistan and the ISI at this point. She really credits them as being continually stirring up the pot, and maybe part of that is kind of instrumental on their part to make themselves an indispensable nation. But there are probably also people that really share the kind of the worldview of the Taliban and the ISI. But she said another thing that I thought was quite interesting, and this goes back to the initial conquest takeover of throwing out of the Taliban using the Northern League and the warlords. She pointed out that this guy Sherzai had actually taken Kandahar, and that when Karzai came down to supposedly negotiate, you know, the fall of Kandahar, that he was basically told, you know, you can't put your own person in there. This guy worked with us. This is the U.S. military talking. Sherzai has to stay. This is sort of acknowledging that it was, you know, fiefdom, warlords, one warlord, one vote kind of approach to ruling in Afghanistan. I just read, I've been searching around for this a little bit, Sherzai was then replaced after some demonstrations happened down in Kandahar in, I think, 2003 or 4. But he's back there now, even with an even more powerful position, and apparently has good relations with the military. So it just seems to me that, you know, this idea that we were selling, that this Karzai was you know, the head of this democratic project, was even undermined by the U.S. Role at the very inception.
Well, you actually
sorted that out for us.
It's a long comment, and there are many topics that come out of it. And by the way, Sarah Chase is, I think, one of the most admirable people involved in any kind of work in Afghanistan, and she knows Kandahar, I think, as well as any foreigner could possibly know it. And I really admire her and her efforts there, and she's really made a commitment to the Afghan people. And I think we all, the United States' face in Afghanistan is really well represented by a person like that. And her assessment of the situation concerning Sherzai and others, I think, is also correct. At the same time, if you heard earlier, I was talking about the approach that the Afghan tribal society follows, which is to trying to build consensus rather than to create confrontation. And that has a lot to do with the current situation relating to Sherzai, but it also relates to what you have alluded, and that, you know, has to do with the allies that the United States made in the very beginning of this war on terrorism, with the members of the Northern Alliance who helped them to fight with the Taliban, fight against the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And those are things that have been a kind of carryovers that have made it difficult also for Hamid Karzai to carry on his political campaigns, and they are at issues there. And I think also, you know, your comment about the Pakistani military and their efforts is on, as well as I indicated in my earlier answer to what we were talking about. That this is very, very critical. And, of course, most of the people coming into Afghanistan in this neo-Taliban movement come from inside Pakistan somewhere and are, you know, pouring across this porous border that Afghanistan shares with Pakistan. And as that continues, then, you know, the prospects for good security are going to be very, very difficult in Afghanistan in the future. Relating to your very first comment about the fact that we worked with the Pakistani ISI, that's true. That was a part of the policy at the time, and the target was the Soviet Union. And there is what others describe as blowback as a result of that. But that often happens, that happens because people pursue a policy at a time when there is an objective that is needs to be addressed immediately, and oftentimes in doing so, one creates issues that later themselves become bigger problems. So then you have, you know, to kind of revisit history and wonder what might have happened, but rather than calling it revisionist history, it's kind of like Monday morning quarterbacking as well, because you confront issues as they face you at the time that you have, with the resources and the options that you have. And we did, and now because we, I think, left the playing field totally in 1989, we made it possible for those issues to become the kind of problem that they are today.
Well, it seems to me that we have to point out that what this means is that all the things that were said about trying to establish, you know, self-rule this was all, like I say, instrumental. We didn't give a hang about the Afghans themselves. We were just using them. And Brzezinski says as much himself, since he was actually the kind of the architect of the thing. Who cares about a few riled up Muslims or something to that effect? It needs to be examined carefully, I think.
I think you're right there, but you got to remember that Brzezinski, when he was the architect of that program, there was a lot that was done thereafter in the Reagan administration, and so there was a time to reevaluate, and there were many, many congressional, participants who were very, very eager to truly help the Afghans in addition to defeating the Soviet Union. You had a lot of people who were lining up because they felt this was our chance to get back at the Soviet Union after Vietnam and all these various things that were there. But there were many, many individuals, many whom I met, people like Bill Bradley and Dante Fassel and many others who were determined that this should be not only to help to defeat the Soviet Union, but to help the Afghans regain their country and to rebuild it. What happened, of course, is that we helped them to regain their country, but we stopped on the rebuilding essentially after the Soviets left. We started focusing elsewhere, and I think that's very, very much to our discredit. And the blowback for that for us is that we now are, you know, having to, you know, having taken it in the butt because of it, having to spend far more money, than we would have trying to help the Afghans to rebuild starting in 89.
We have about 10 minutes left. I hope the caller will forgive me. I got some other people I want to get here. Thomas Gutierrez, our guest. He's director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. And we're talking about Afghanistan, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. White Heath is next. This is line two. Hello.
Hi. I was just wondering how you see the possibility of the United States attacking Iran, what that would do to the Afghanistan problems that are increasing by the day and week, if that would have an effect.
Well, it would of course, immediately complicate our whole position in the Middle East and take, again, a focus away from what we are doing in Afghanistan, because it's a much bigger issue in many ways, because it's one that will spread out well beyond just even the borders of Iran, as we see because of their recent events in the areas of, you know, Israel and Lebanon and the Hezbollah, and so it's something that I hope we're going to find for sure some way around in a diplomatic fashion, because it would be a very, very impossible situation. If we would take on Iran in any way militarily, it'd be even more difficult and complicated for us than is the situation in Iraq. We would have a nation that would be much more united against us, even though they have divisions within Iran now. We would, by just attacking Iran, help the Iranians to solidify their nation in many ways against a common enemy. Also, Iran, if you look at your map, is a much larger area physically, logistically, to try and handle than is Iraq itself. And in many ways, also, the thing that we would wind up doing is we would wind up doing something that hasn't been able to be done by Muslims throughout their history, and that we would probably wind up uniting Sunni and Shia Muslims throughout the Muslim world against a common enemy, and that would be seen as the United States. So that would not be good for our situation in any stretch in Afghanistan. While in Afghanistan, the sectarian split of Shia and Sunni Islam is not as severe a problem as it is in Iraq today, it still is a very, very important part of the Afghan patchwork quilt of ethnic, linguistic, historic, regional, and religious divisions. And we too then would find, I think, many within Afghanistan who would be dismayed by this further expansion of what might be seen by some as a Western crusade against Islam.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for your answer.
All right, thanks. Let's go to Urbana here, line number three. Hello.
Hi, Tom. This is Mubin Shurish.
Hi, Mubin. How are you doing?
Not bad.
Salamat Bashin.
I have the same type of feeling like you had regarding Taliban, and it is really part of history of Afghanistan, where the rural area become disaffected and frustrated with the central government. This happened under Amanullah. This happened under the Taliban when they took almost over Afghanistan, and people welcomed them, because of the problem with the Mujahideen government. And right now, quite a lot of the so-called development that goes on in the cities and the urban areas, rural areas, are quite desperate and devastated. So I think it's the Taliban, as we knew it earlier, I think they have evolved also. So there's quite a lot of the resurgence that we see in Helmand, for example, of all places, and also the rest of the South and East, is quite a lot of them, maybe these are local people that are just getting tired of corruption, of the Karzai government, and frankly, occupation by the NATO and the U.S. forces. So that it is ominous because one does not want the horrific government that Taliban used to have. But I think the Taliban have evolved in the fact that they had the foothold in Helmand.
Well, I think you're right, and I think, you know, the Taliban are not in any way stupid, Mubin. And for the listeners, I should mention that Mubin and I have known each other for many, many years. He's a native of Herat, western Afghanistan, and a real expert, of course, on his country of origin. And but I think, you know, you're right. The Taliban, in many ways, sprang up, as well you know, in the 90s as an expression of their frustration and the corruption of that time under the Mujahideen warlords, etc. They were trying to regain control over parts of Afghanistan, and there's a lot of that frustration even today, of course, in Afghanistan, and the corruption is even higher because there's more money there, because all of these massive reconstruction projects, and when people see that individuals who are linked with this group or that individual who is making a lot of money, people who they feel may know well the leadership here or there in the country, and then they themselves are still suffering, they become very, very dispirited and frustrated, though they don't want to go back to that oppressive style of living that the Taliban keep talking about, that Afghanistan and the Afghans should live like all Muslims lived exactly during the time of the Prophet Muhammad. Afghans don't like that. They like to enjoy music and parties and life and liberty and have opportunities. They still are frustrated in that they don't see that this new set of circumstances is really changing their individual lives for the better, and so they they become somewhat ambiguous about how they're going to deal with one side or the other in this thing. And in many ways, they do what they feel they have to do in order to survive. And the Taliban know very well how to play upon those kinds of emotions. And I think that, again, this gets back to what I was saying in the earlier part of the program, that the frustrations that the Afghans feel, more than any other thing, is attributable to the expectations they have and the fact that these have not been realized, whether this is due to the ineffectiveness of the Karzai government and their perceptions, or the ineffectiveness of the Karzai government's coalition allies and their donor projects. But doesn't matter what are the sources in many ways. It what really matters is that these now are their perceptions, and when you deal with these perceptions, it's very difficult to change them. And we need to be more focused, the U.S., in making sure that whatever Afghan government is in power has the respect and the trust of the people, even if they don't agree with all of their politics. That's, again, a part of the political fabric of Afghanistan. But at least so that people are engaged with the government towards towards the reconstruction of their own country. And I think, Mubin, you put the nail on the head when you're talking about the frustration with this perceived corruption and the ineffectiveness. It really plays into the hands of the neo-Taliban and the way they're going about their campaign.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. We're pretty much at the point where we have to stop. And given what you've just said, though, and I'm thinking back to the editorial in today's Times that an earlier caller mentioned, talking about just how important Afghanistan is, then it sort of gets to the question, you've touched on it in a general way, it gets to the question very specifically, what should the United States be doing?
Well, the United States needs to redirect its focus on Afghanistan. We're not going to be pulling out of Iraq anytime soon, particularly under the current administration. And I don't want to go into that particular issue, but let's just say we're going to be remaining in Iraq. But we need to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time and do both well. And what we're not doing as well as we can in Afghanistan is to have a really good coordinated program there. We're relying on these donor conferences, which really produces sometimes nowhere near the money that is promised and nowhere near the type of coordination in the development and reconstruction schemes that the Afghans need. So it makes the Afghans look inept. It increases the prospects for corruption, and it makes us look inept. And what we need to do is really refocus our planning as we go about Afghanistan. We've done a lot of massive things, which we've done for political spin, and some which have been done because they what was really required. But now we need to really be focusing on what I call community-based reconstruction for Afghanistan, finding ways to train those Afghans who are engaged in militias or with the Taliban or with the drug business, finding ways to train them into new occupations so that they can be feeling a part, that they're a part of this new nation of a rebirthed Afghanistan.
Well, there we will have to leave it. Our guest, Thomas Gutierrez, is director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska. He's also dean of international studies and programs there, University of Nebraska, Omaha. Dr. Gutierrez, thanks very much.
It's nice to have been with you. Thank you very, very much for having me.